Welcome to the Resilient Migrant Podcast, a podcast where African immigrants get to talk about their experiences as they assimilate to a different country. This is your host, Brenda Mure.
Hello, hello, hello. I am back recording the podcast. It's been quite a while, but I'm glad today to have one of my friends that I met on the social media platforms. Welcome, Monga Chulu.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I can't wait to talk to you. I know you're one of my guests who asked me a very direct question. You're like, Brenda, why did you call me? And I gave you, I know I rambled to the answer, for the answer, but one of the things is because you really have a resilient story that I want you to talk to my guests about, my listeners about. So welcome again. First, before we start, I would like to know where you were born.
Thank you so much. Yeah, my name is Monga Chulu Abila. Last name is A-B-I-L-A, and I was born in Zambia.
Okay, so did you go to school in Zambia when you were young, primary, high school?
I did. I went to both primary and secondary school in Zambia, and then I actually did 1 year at the university there. But then the university closed. You know how that story goes. Mm-hmm. The university closed, and I was home for a few months, and then that's when I started applying to the U.S., and I came to the U.S. for college.
Okay. So what did you go, when you went to college, what were you studying in Zambia?
I was in the first year of what they call natural sciences. In the Zambian university system, in the first year, they kind of put you in categories. So I was in the natural sciences category. And from then on, people go into medicine, agriculture, and different disciplines. But the first year is called natural sciences. So that's what I had started doing until before they closed.
It's weird when you say that schools closed. Most people do not understand that that's an issue in some third world countries. I come from Kenya and we used to have the same problem. That's why I migrated to the States, because these issues happen a lot. So when you moved from Zambia to the US, you said you went for studies. So did you go and study natural sciences?
So in the U.S., it's a little bit different. In the U.S., it's kind of set up where you do a bachelor's degree first, and then you move into a master's or some other program. So I started with a bachelor's degree in biology with the intention to kind of continue in the medicine of sciences and continue in the path of sciences and going into medicine. But I realized very quickly that there was no way I was going to pay for medical school. As an international student with, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, I didn't have that. So there was no way that I was going to be able to continue in this path of medicine. So I kind of had to depart from that path. And after my bachelor's degree, I did a master's degree in public health instead, so I could get into the workforce and start working and earning a little bit of money.
Wow. Can you... I was just listening to you talking, and I was just thinking about the student path as an international student. And that's one of the things that I think most people who are citizens of countries don't understand, that international students pay up to three times the school fees. So when you came to the States, can you tell me some of the challenges you first faced? Apart from that situation with the school fees, what are some of the challenges or cultural shocks that you had?
Well, I do want to say the financial thing is big, right?
Oh, yes.
The financial thing is big, and it just kind of dictates the way you live. I remember I was working almost all the time, and a lot of my money was actually going toward my student account. That was the agreement I had with the school, whereby I'd work at the student finance office, and I'll do all this work. But at the end of 2 weeks, I just had a little bit of money, because all of it, 80% of it, was being deducted toward my school account. So one cultural thing that was different is that these, you know, a lot of my college mates would just spend all their money. They would work, and then they would just have this money to spend. And then they'd ask me, well, how come you work all the time, but you never have any money? Because my 80% of my money was being deducted and going into my student account. So that was one thing that was different for sure. And, you know, my roommate would call her parents and say, oh, did you guys put money in my account? And I would just sometimes listen and be like, oh my gosh, that must be nice. Oh. Off to work I go.
Wow. I mean, I just listen to that and I'm like, you just give me memories of my own time being in school. Thanks for sharing that piece of story. So when you came, when you went to the States, I know you had these big thoughts about America, lavish lifestyle. Is there one thing that, one story that always is in your mind about how your life changed when you went to the States? Anything?
I mean, all of a sudden, you're responsible for everything and you have to figure it out. Mm-hmm. I hadn't really had a job back in Zambia. So when I came to the U.S., it was like, okay, how am I going to make it? Mm-hmm. How am I going to make it? I mean, my parents could send me some money, but it wasn't enough for, you know, you have a personal hygiene needs and all that kind of stuff. I just needed to find the money, for that, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So really, I think the hard part is that you have to figure everything out. You have to figure out insurance. Well, what is insurance? How do I get it? Oh, it costs this much. You know, who helps me get it? Okay, so I have to kind of have a bank account. Okay, yeah, I need what's called a social security number. And all of these things are swirling in your head and you have to figure it out.
That's a tough one when you're that young.
Yes. When you're young, that's actually really tough. And then of course you make all the mistakes. You, like you're saying, you're thinking that America is going to be this flashy place. So you come here and you work and you foolishly spend your money on clothes because you want to take pictures that you want to send back home so that you look like you're having a good time. You wow. want to buy the music. At that time, it was CDs. You want to buy the CDs and tell people that, oh, I have this new CD. Dr. Dre has a new album, all that stuff, you know. But meanwhile, it's tough. Meanwhile, you're just kind of figuring out, how am I going to pay to stay here?
That's true. And bills. Mm-hmm. So I want to jump over to you starting to work in the health field. Mm-hmm. I believe you were a nurse for a while. How many years did you do nursing?
So I'll tell you my path. I kind of went a reverse way. So after I did my master's in public health, which was, I focused on health administration. So I worked in health administration, healthcare technology for a few years. And then I had my kids. And then after I had my kids, I stayed at home for a while. And then when I tried to get back in the workforce, it was very difficult because I'd had this hiatus. I'd had this break in my work history and it was really hard to get back to work. So I knew that I had to reinvent myself. So because I was already in healthcare technology, I knew that there were certain roles that you could only get if you had a clinical license. So because I already had a bachelor's degree in biology, so it was easier for me to just do the prerequisites and then jump onto an accelerated nursing program. So that's what I ended up doing. And then even after I got the nursing license, I never did patient care because that's not what I wanted to do. I always knew I wanted the clinical license to pair with my experience in healthcare technology. So after I got my nursing license, I was able to get a role in clinical informatics, which is kind of what I was doing for a while. And then, you know, COVID hit and some things changed there. But yes, I got a clinical license, but never with the intention of doing patient care. I knew that I wanted to use it in healthcare technology to get certain type of roles that paid more because you had a clinical license.
And you're not now doing that. You went to something else, which I want us to discuss as we go along. You are doing stocks full time.
Oh my gosh. I have lived many lives, girl.
Unbelievable, from health informatics to stocks. Take us through the path.
I have lived many lives. So, okay. So here I am. I'm working in informatics and then COVID hits. And I worked at the time at a cancer hospital out here. I'm near Los Angeles. And as you can imagine, during COVID, a lot of things were going on. I mean, COVID was there, but it didn't mean that cancer disappeared, right? So even though COVID, this pandemic, what was happening, we still had to figure out how to continue care for these cancer patients. So I was in a healthcare technology role, informatics role, but that means a lot of documentation was changing, right? Because we didn't know what COVID was. We didn't know how long COVID, you know, was going to last. Mm-hmm. So there were so many changes. And, in my role, it was just crazy. It was just absolutely crazy. My days would be raining emails and meetings. And at the same time, my kids were home for school because it was COVID and kids were sent home. Mm-hmm. Now I have two daughters. One is 12 and one is 13. My 13-year-old has autism and she's on a special education program at school. So during the time that we were home, she has this special education curriculum that I'm expected to implement, and I have no idea what I'm doing. You can imagine, I don't know if you have any knowledge or your audience has any knowledge of autism, but she can't work independently. So I was literally losing my mind. I was stressed out all the time. My skin was breaking out. I have alopecia already and it was getting worse because I was in this very, very stressful situation. And I remember one day taking a call, a meeting appeared on my calendar, and I remember just needing to take this call. And the closest place that I could go to get some peace and quiet was the bathroom. So I go into the bathroom and my daughter, you know, my autistic daughter, she's following me into the bathroom. She doesn't understand that mommy is busy or whatever. And I'm literally pushing her out of the bathroom. And I still remember she was looking at me like, why are you pushing me out? But I had to take this meeting. And then I closed the door and I remember looking at myself in the mirror like, man, this is crazy. I'm not doing this. This is not a life. I'm failing at work and I'm failing at home. I don't know if you've ever felt that way. It's just like nothing is working. Mm-hmm. So then I ended up taking a leave of absence. I could, because I have a daughter with special needs, I took a leave of absence. Mm-hmm. And then during that time, I decided I need to do something different. Mm-hmm. Now at the time, I was kind of playing around with a travel blog, and then I had seen that people travel and make money while they travel. Well, how do they do it? So that's how I fell into the idea of trading stocks for an income. Now, I had been in the stock market for years before, even before my kids were born. I would buy and sell stocks, but I didn't know what I was doing in the beginning. I would just go on Yahoo Finance and see what people are talking about, and then maybe try to buy and then sell, maybe lose. So at first I didn't know what I was doing, but then I got a little bit better over the years. And then during COVID is when I took a class and I really buckled down to learn. And soon it got to a place where I was replacing my income. I was replacing my income trading stocks. So it's like, well, why? It was no longer worth it for me to give my time to a job when I could trade stocks and make the same money and more, as a matter of fact. So that's kind of how I ended up doing what I'm doing now. So I resigned from the job, from employment, December of 2021. Yeah. So I've been, you know, out of the workforce now for almost a year and I trade full time.
And one of the things that you also do is train people on stocks. That's quite a story. I want us to, in a few minutes, to also talk about your daughter. But as we talk about stocks, I'm the kind of person, I hope my listeners, some of them are like me, who really do not understand the word of stocks. Mm-hmm. So what would be your advice for somebody who's very skeptical? Because if you ask me, stocks is gambling. What would be our advice, and what do you think I should do to start that process?
Okay. So I want to take you back. I want to take you back a few years. I want to take you back a few years to where way before I had my kids, I worked in a small software company, and there was a running joke in the company that the president of the company would come in every day and all he did was look at stocks, right? And his office was opposite from mine. So I could see that, you know, he would look at stocks. And Brenda, to this day, I wonder what would have happened if I had just asked him, hey, Mr. President, could you just show me what you look at in the stock market? could you, I'd love to understand what you do in the stock market. Could you tell me a little bit more about it? I wonder how different my life would have been. This was decades ago. How different would my life have been if I had been exposed to the same information that other folks have been doing for generations? So what I want to say is a lot of people are afraid of the stock market because they think it's not for them. People like us, I want to say me particular, an African girl, I didn't think that the stock market was for somebody like me. I thought it was for people who are rich and people who have trust funds. So it was not even in my vocabulary or even in my place. I didn't even think it was in my place to ask this gentleman to talk to me about the stock market because it was completely outside of my world. So this is my mission now. This is what drives my mission now. I feel like people are still think that the stock market is something that is not for them. But I want to say today that the stock market is available for anyone who's willing to try. There are people like you and me every day making thousands, tens of thousands of dollars in the market every day, every day. And I also want to say for somebody who is thinking that trading is gambling, it can be a gamble if you don't know what you're doing, right? If you just take your money and throw it in the ring and then hope it sticks, that is gambling. But if you have the education and you know when to buy and when to sell, and then also what's really important is having a trading plan. So a trading plan is something you set up so that you know your risk ahead of time. So I have a way of trading where I know my risk ahead of time. Like, okay, if I'm only willing to lose $100 in this trade, then I'm going to set up the trade so that I only lose $100, right? So I'm not jumping in there and then just hoping. And then, you know, I end up losing all this money and, you know, unplanned in a crazy chaotic way. No, there's a way to do it where you're educated and you're buying and selling at the right price, right? Because you know how to set it up. And then that way your risk is mitigated. So if you throw your money in there and you're hoping it's going to work, well, that's a gamble.
So I just have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, shares queen, so I'm going to ask this. Mm-hmm. So when I think of people who do stocks, I think of people who are always on the computer 8 hours, 24 hours or whatever. And I don't want to take that chance of leaving my full-time job and doing shares because I don't know what I'm doing. So what would be your advice for somebody like me or somebody who wants to start slow? Mm-hmm. Like, I know you talked about the trading plan. What are the, especially for beginners, what would be your encouragement?
Okay, so the way I trade and the way I teach students is that in the beginning, you should have a narrow focus. You should have a very narrow focus of stocks that you watch. I know everybody's thinking of, you know, what we see in the movies with somebody sitting there with thousands of screens. That it doesn't have to be that way. If you focus on a narrow list of stocks that you watch, you get to know those stocks intimately. You get to know their charts because there are certain charts that we look at that tell us when to buy and when to sell. So you look at those, only those few charts, right? Mm-hmm. So you do your planning, say on a Sunday, and you say, hey, something like Boeing is getting to a level where I think I might want to buy. So then you decide you're going to watch Boeing that week, right? That's all you're doing. And then there's a way to set alerts saying, hey, if Boeing gets to my price, if Boeing gets to 120, then send me a text, right? Send me a text. And then only then will I say, okay, Boeing is at the number that I want. And then I'm going to go in there and buy. And then another thing too, I trade 90-95% on my phone, right? Technology is what it is now. There's some excellent trading apps, right, you know, out there. I love TD Ameritrade. That's who I trade with primarily. And you can do everything on your phone. You can do absolutely everything on your phone. If you have an internet connection, you can trade on anything, right? So I'm hardly ever on my computer, right? I can get in a trade downstairs. I can go upstairs and start doing laundry. I can go to the store, whatever. I can monitor my trade on my phone. And remember, I talked about predetermining your risk. If you set up your trade in a certain way, you can put what is called a stop loss. Most people don't know what that is, a stop loss. And a stop loss is exactly that. It's something that keeps you from losing too much. something that keeps you from losing more than you're willing to lose. So if I'm already in a trade and I've already secured my stop loss, I know that the maximum I'm willing to lose on this trade is $50, then I'm set. Nothing will tie me to my trade. It's going to all work out and execute automatically. And I can also set where I want to take my profit. So I can say I'm willing to lose $50. And if it gets to where my loss is $50, it'll, you know, I'll be automatically taken out of the trade. And then I could also set it up like, hey, when my profit is 200, take my profit. So I can set all that stuff up.
Well, 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 you're teaching us a lot and I'm learning a lot. I've gone to some of the clips that you've put on your Facebook and your Instagram, which I'll let you tell viewers in a little while where we can find you on social media. And I've learned a lot. I'm starting to have faith in stocks because of your lessons.
Good. And that's what I want. That's what I want. I want people to see that the stock market is not this big, ugly machine, right? If you know how to work it, it's not a big, ugly machine that will take all your money. It'll take your money if you don't know what you're doing, sure.
Mm. So before we turn the topic to something else, there's something I heard you speak in one of the clips called paper trading. What is that?
Okay, wonderful. A lot of people don't know what that is. So paper trading is a way you can actually practice how to trade stocks without using your real money. So if you're somebody who wants to dip your toes in, but don't quite want to use your money yet, or you want to dip your toes in, but don't yet have the money, you can absolutely do what's called paper trading. So this is where you can use fake money, almost like monopoly money, but using real market data. So you can go in and buy shares of Apple as if you're buying for real on the market, right? And then you can sell them. And then, you know, potentially make a profit as if you were doing it for real. Of course, it's all on paper, but it's really, really good practice. And it lets you, you know, get a feel of how to press the buttons and how to, you know, look at charts and that kind of thing. So when I start teaching students, I never want anybody to throw in their real money. Never. I want you to first start with paper trading because that's how you're going to kind of get used to the stocks you trade. And how you're going to get used to navigating the system. In fact, it's a mistake for somebody to start with real money. It's a mistake for somebody to start with a lot of money because in the beginning, if you don't know what you're doing, you can lose it. So that's why I absolutely say paper trading is invaluable. And I paper trade too sometimes when I'm still learning a particular stock that maybe I'm not as familiar with, or I'm testing a new strategy or something like that. I still paper trade. So any person who is just starting or even trying to develop their skill and perfect their skill, paper trading is absolutely essential.
Great, great lessons from you, Monga. Wow, I'm learning a lot and I'm sure my listeners are learning. So before I turn this conversation to the next topic, is there anything else you'd like my listeners to know about stocks? I know you love this field, so anything from you, go right ahead.
Oh, I can talk stocks all day. I can talk stocks all day. The real takeaway that I would want people to know is that when you get in the stock market, a lot of people think it's because you have lofty ambitions, like you want to buy a Lamborghini. I use this, you know, you see, you know, the people online and they have a Lamborghini and, you know, they make it seem too good to be true, right? But I want to tell you that if you're in the stock market, you don't have to have lofty ambitions of fancy cars and fancy homes or whatever. You could be somebody who just wants to create breathing room in your budget. I have students who have a goal of making $50 a day. If you make $50 a day for 5 days, that's $250. That's your groceries. That's your gas. That's daycare. That's ballet lessons or basketball uniforms. That's money to send home for those of us who are immigrants. You know, there's always a call of something is happening back home. So that could be your money that you send back home, $250 a week. That makes a difference, right? That makes a difference in somebody's budget. So I want people to know that you don't have to have lofty ambitions. You could be somebody who just wants to create breathing room in your budget. Somebody who wants just a little extra, right? A little extra to make life a little bit easier. So don't look at the stock market as, you know, something just for the wealthy, something for rich people to do. No, no, no. It's available for anyone who wants to try, and you can make $100 a week, $500 a week, and that'll make a difference in your budget in the long term.
Thank you for sharing that, Monga, about that. I want us to turn the topic about your daughter. You said your 13-year-old daughter has autism.
Right.
I think the first question I want to ask is, what is autism?
Well, without going into too much detail, and also because there's so much about autism is not understood. So autism is a neurological disorder where the biggest manifestation, I would say, is communication, or a lack, not being able to communicate. So autism is on a spectrum. So there are some that are higher functioning than others. Higher functioning would be somebody who's able to talk, but maybe lacks some of the social skills that you'd expect of a person at a particular age, or they maybe just like to talk, but only talk about a particular topic and lack those social cues. That's on one end of the spectrum. And then some in the middle may not communicate as well. And then on the lower end of the spectrum, they may be nonverbal or, not be able to, on the low end, maybe still have issues with toileting and stuff like that. So I'm telling you all these things to let you know there's a wide spectrum. And if you know one kid with autism, you know one kid with autism. they're all completely different. They're all completely different because it's all kind of on a spectrum. Now with my daughter, she's able to talk. She can communicate her needs and she can answer questions, but you cannot have a conversation with her like you would with a typical neurotypical 13-year-old kid. So she thrives on routine. Kids with autism thrive on routine. They like to do things a certain way. So my daughter, she likes to wake up at a certain time. Like today, she was very frustrated because she woke up late. And that was because she took some Benadryl last night because she was having some a runny nose and stuff like that. So she woke up frustrated because she was late. In her book, she was late. She was okay, but in her book, she was late. So they get frustrated that, you know, things are not on the same routine. So those are some of the things that you'll see in kids who have autism. But again, you know one kid with autism, you know one kid with autism. They're all very different, but that's how my daughter is.
Thank you so for sharing, talking about your daughter. I want to take us back to the first time you got that news. And this being an immigrant show, we always talk about our cultural background, our cultural beliefs, and how they come into play in everything that we do. So when you first heard the news, take me through your thought process or anything you want to share, considering you are a mom, you have a nursing background, and you have your African belief about some things. Just talk us through that and what you went through.
Okay, so the official diagnosis for autism comes after 3. So before that, one of the most telling signs that a child has autism is not being able to talk. So in the beginning, I mean, she would talk a little bit, but then by the time she's like two and a half and getting closer to 3, that's when you really get concerned, like, oh, hey, how come she's not talking? And then there are other things too, where they do what's called stemming, where they'll flap their hands or kind of rock back and forth, or just things like that. Other things that kind of let you know, I think that there's something going on. Although my husband, being in healthcare, kind of knew, but it's kind of a little bit different when she's your child. So she was officially diagnosed at 3, and then now we had to roll up our sleeves and figure out, well, what is it that we do? So you get her into the therapy early. Getting early therapy is really, really important. So we got her into the therapy early and just trying to learn, like, well, how do we communicate with this child, or how do we help her develop? I'll tell you now, talking about the African thing. So we took our kids back to Zambia, and my husband's from Kenya. So Zambia and Kenya, when my kids were, I think we first took them when my older daughter, I think was two, I think before three, before that diagnosis. So as she grew a little bit older, I started to worry about what it would be like to take her back home. Because, you know, back home, we're all about discipline. We're all about, oh, this child doesn't behave a certain way. You know what? You need to discipline your children and all that stuff. But being that she was older, but really had the mentality of a toddler. So I was really concerned about taking her home and explaining why it is that she behaved the way, why she doesn't behave her age. So I was really concerned that I'll be looked at as a bad mom. Like, why is her child so indisciplined? But, you know, I finally, when we went and then my family saw her and started to understand her, it was such a big relief for me because I felt like I didn't have to now defend my parenting or my motherhood on why I'm not able to discipline this child, right? So when my mom, especially, you know, had a talk with me and said that, you know, you should be patient with her. This is the child that God has given you. That gave me more peace and more like, okay, you know what? I felt that it was easier for me to just accept that, hey, this is my child, or easier for people to accept that, hey, this is my child and this is how she behaves and this is just how it's going to be. And then I started teaching them, okay, this is how you talk to her. And then now my family knows her. Now my family knows her and knows how to interact with her and stuff like that. So that gives me a lot of peace. But in the beginning, trust me, I was very stressed out about going back to Africa because, you know, for us, we say, I know kids should be seen and not heard, all that stuff, you know, but, you know, when a child is atypical, you know, people don't have the words to describe except that that child behaves badly. And unfortunately, I've heard of, you know, autistic kids being locked up. Makes me really, really sad. I've heard of autistic kids being, you know, locked up and not being taken out to any social events because parents, I think that they just don't know how to handle it. They don't know how to handle the stares. They don't know how to handle the judgment. So they just kind of keep their kids at home, you know? So it is tough in the African sense. It is tough because here's a child who's supposed to behave a certain way, but then they just can't because they're developmentally not there yet.
Great, great lessons from you. And you've been doing this for 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
I like the, you mentioned about the, I think it's called early intervention, mm-hmm. which is very, very important for autistic children. Can you just in a nutshell, I know maybe it's not your field, but in a nutshell, say what it does to help the child.
Oh, it helps them learn how to communicate and just it helps them learn how to talk. Like, for example, we had people come into our home and then they teach her how to even the eye contact, even something simple like eye contact. Because kids with autism, that is again, one of the things that you'll notice is lack of eye contact. So when you have early intervention, they actually teach kids how to look at other people and give that eye contact. So when she's asking for something, they say, look at me. And then you train them to look, to give that eye contact. So imagine if you don't have that intervention, a kid can be 11, 12, 13, 14 and not know how to give eye contact because they weren't trained repeatedly. Look at me, look at me, look at me. So those are the things we have to learn. Like when she's asking for something, we say, hey, look at me. And then she at first she would just turn for a little bit and then turn back. But they say, no, look at me. And then she'll keep looking at us, giving us that eye contact. So that's one example of how early intervention really, really works. Now, for us Africans too, sometimes because, you know, some of these things are stigmatized, we may not seek that early intervention because we're kind of, you know, we just don't even know how to, we don't know how to talk about anything mental, right? We don't know how to talk about anything mental. We don't know how to talk about anything emotional. So even to allow your kid to say, hey, this kid has a problem and we need to do something and let's put ourselves out there. Even that is tough, right? So if you don't get early intervention for this kid, if you don't get this kid therapy early, you know, a lot of things just kind of build up on one another. And that's why when kids, as they get older and get more frustrated with not being able to communicate, that's when they start to hit. That's when they start to hurt themselves. That's when they, you know, become just aggressive, more aggressive, because think about it. This kid wants to say something, but they can't get it out. They can't get it out. So they have this aggression and then they start to hit, like, you don't get me or whatever. But then you start to, you know, teach them. Therapy starts to teach them even things like saying yes or to agree to something. Like, do you want this? Yes. They may not understand that yes means I'm in agreement, or no means that I don't want this. So all of that is being, you have to train the kid how to process that.
Very vital information. And I like the fact that you talked about the stigma in the African community. And that's an issue I've seen around of many parents just saying, you know, this is not what Africans do. But mm-hmm. when they miss that vital step, like you said, it affects the child when they're yeah. older. Mm-hmm. So Monga, thank you very much. We've talked a lot. And I like the fact you talked about your daughter, because that's how you ended up even doing this talk, so that you are there for your family. And one of the things for us immigrants is just being resilient, being adaptive. You adjust mm-hmm. to situation. And your story is a resilient story. I'll go back to what I said at the beginning of the show. You asked me, Brenda, why did you call me? You have a resilient story. Adjusting at every level of your life and making these decisions is not easy. So before I ask you about your social media handles, is there any one question you thought I should have asked you but did not ask you?
You know, sometimes when your back is against the wall, you have to figure something out. You have to figure something out. There's no way this kid, it was going to work for me to keep on working and have this kid approach puberty and me being on the road somewhere, you know? Mm-hmm. So that definitely was something that drove me to find a way to do something different.
Another thing I want to mention too, Brenda, is that I started to feel a little bit to handle it all better when I realized that having a child with special needs is actually a loss and therefore has to be processed as a loss. I have to go through the stages, right? To go through the stages of grief and loss. Because it is a loss. It's a loss of the idea of how you thought motherhood would be like. It's a loss of the idea of what you thought your child was going to be, right? You think your child is going to be this or that, and then you realize, well, this is just how it's going to be. For our daughter, we just know that she's probably going to be with us for our lifetime and her lifetime. So we just now plan accordingly. We just know she's always going to be with us, and she probably will not be able to live independently, not for a long period of time anyway. So once I got to a place where I actually processed it as a loss, things started to get better for me, and I started to accept how things were, and then could also now think about how we're going to plan for the future. But that didn't happen until I started accepting it as a loss. Because if you don't accept it as a loss, you keep hoping, right? You keep hoping and hoping that your child is going to be something they're probably never going to be.
Great, great lesson. And before I end, I know I keep saying we're ending. I have some fun questions that I need to ask you. I like people relaxing on this show.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me what color school uniform you wore in primary school.
It was purple. It was purple. It was kind of weird. It was like a purple kitenge, like purple and then like some kitenge designs as well. I went to like this a smaller private school, but yeah, but it was a kitenge purple. Yeah.
What color socks did you wear?
White. It was always white. Yeah.
Wow. Great. So teach us something. I think the last time I spoke to you, you told me you come from the Tonga tribe. Teach us a word or something in Tonga.
Let's see. Mwapona.
Mwapona.
Mwapona means you're well.
Oh, Mwapona.
Kind of like, okay, yeah. Just a general greeting. Mwapona means you're well, kind of question mark. And then you'd say yes. So Mwapona.
Is it a Bantu language, Tonga?
It is. So a lot of words, you know, you from Kenya, a lot of Tonga words are actually similar to Swahili.
Yeah, that's why I asked, because in Swahili, when we say umepona, means you are well too. So
exactly. You'll find a lot of correlation there.
Mm-hmm. Umepona, great. Mm-hmm. And what's your favorite Zambian meal?
Well, we eat, it's called nshima, which is like ugali. And, you know, fufu or whatever, the same kind of like staple. And then let's see, what do I like to eat with? Oh, you know what? There's this thing, it's called musohia. And it's, pumpkin, like sweet pumpkin with, maize, boiled maize.
Mm.
And a bit of sugar. Oh, it tastes so good.
Wow. Do you usually eat it with something?
No, just like that, the sweet pumpkin with cornmeal, with, corn, like dried corn. It's really tasty.
Great. Mm-hmm. Wow. So last question, what's your favorite music?
I'm very, very varied in my taste. Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. I listen to everything. I listen to African music. I listen to hymns. I listen to, you know, Christian music. I listen to whatever. Pop thing is, I don't know that I can pinpoint, but I have a very, very varied taste. Yeah.
Great. You just get into the groove.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So Monga, where can we find you on social media? Tell us all your social media handles and so we can get in touch with you.
Wonderful. So on Instagram, my handle is The Stock Sisterhood. So The Stock Sisterhood, THESTOCKSISTERHOOD, The Stock Sisterhood on Instagram. That's where I post quite frequently. And then also you can just find me on Facebook. My profile is public under Monga, MONGA. Last name is Abila, AB as in boy, ILA. And if you connect on there, I share a lot of stuff about stocks, just a lot of tips about stocks and how you can get in. It's an exciting world. Come and join me.
Thank you. Again, as I say, I love your social media platforms. You're really doing well. I'm learning a lot. I'm sure people will be learning a lot. I want to say thank you so much. And in Swahili, we say asante sana. Thank you, Monga, for coming to this podcast.
Of course. Have a nice day.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.